Good evening. I promised my students in Arabic to give a lecture in Arabic. Although I'm in Arabic, it's time for you to take a class. Assalamu alaikum. I'm going to do the first thing, the first important thing, not to say that our speakers are not the first important thing, but we need to get funding. This is a student event. The main organizers were students, and you know how difficult it is to make the budget and to make such an event successful. So we're going to have baskets that are going to go around, and don't be shy. I know that a latte is more than $3 in Berkeley, and you could go for a week without your latte. You should be able to donate $10 plus or minus, and those who can give a 20, right, please do so to support this event. This is the only way that such events could be successful, since we don't have much support from state apparatus to present the Palestinian community. Having said that, it's always interesting to attend and come to a lecture and find students that were missing in class attending the lecture. So I will say that you were absent from the class, but I'll put that you were present if you turn the paper. Summation of the lectures of both of our distinguished speaker, and your one day absence will be marked as being present since you have elevated your consciousness by attending. Also, I'd like to thank everyone in here for coming out and missing the most important debate on the issue of America. A debate that you know for sure Palestine is absent because you have not heard anything about Palestine, anything. Throughout the past 40 debates, absent completely from the most important, supposedly the most important election for us to have, and it seems that both parties, Democrats and Republicans, outdo each other in their love for Israel. We would ask if they love America at the same level that they would indicate in their rhetoric relative to the Palestine-Israel conflict. As you monitor today, and I was speaking to many people, if you monitor the news, there is no mention whatsoever of the conditions in Palestine. You are hardly pressed to find any type of coverage on the daily suffering that takes place in Palestine. You don't find anything being mentioned on the impact of the war and the continued impact of the war, the continued expansion of settlements, the restrictions on movement. And the only possible news that is filtered is only when violence takes place, especially relative to the Gaza Strip. The reality on the ground is still that the Palestinians are facing tremendous amount of oppression and restrictions that the international community needs to pay far more attention to it, and in particular here in the U.S. Often we say that the question of how to bring peace to the Middle East. Peace has to be by recognizing the legitimate rights of the Palestinian, and it means not negotiating, the Palestinians not having to negotiate both with Israel and the U.S., because often the Palestinians were at the negotiating theaters, negotiating with the U.S. and Israel on one side, and the Palestinians being left to fetch for themselves. So it's, we have to change the discourse, we have to change the dynamics. Now, you did not come here to listen to me, and I will go ahead and introduce our speakers. Professor John Bogart, who will be our first speaker, was appointed to the chair in public international law in 1998. He is a graduate of the universities of Stellenbosch, South Africa, and Cambridge. In 1998, Cambridge University conferred the LLD degree on him. He has been awarded honorary degrees in law by the universities of Natal, Cape Town, and Port Elizabeth. For many years, he was a professor of law at the University of Witwatersrand, Johannesburg, during which time he was dean in 1975-1977, and director of the Center for Applied Legal Studies, 1978-1990. He has held visiting positions in the United States, Princeton, Duke, and Berkeley, for those who missed him while he was visiting here the last time, and Pennsylvania. Currently, I heard he just is visiting at Duke University for this year. He has written and contributed to the subject of international law tremendously, but he is far more known at this particular time for the many protests that are accorded to him, and I think many of you saw the flyers that were handed out at the entrance, and I say that's a sign of his success for speaking truth to power. He was appointed as the UN Rapporteur on Diplomatic Protection to the Commission, and he was the Special Rapporteur since 2001 to the occupied Palestinian territory. Would you please help me welcome Professor John Rivera? Thank you, Chairman. Thank you for the kind words of introduction. It's always good to hear one CV read out. And perhaps I should say something about the position of Special Rapporteur to the UN Human Rights Council. The Human Rights Council appoints rapporteurs to report on situations which affect human rights. And I was appointed in 2001 to report on human rights violations in occupied Palestinian territory, which required me to visit the West Bank, Gaza, and Israel twice a year for 8 years and report to the Human Rights Council and to the General Assembly. So those are my credentials. I do know the region, and I have seen the violation of human rights on the ground, so to speak. The subject that we're going to speak about tonight, the Israel-Palestine conflict, can be viewed from many perspectives, from a historical perspective. Many like to go back to biblical times to explain the present situation, or can look at it in the political context, and ask the question whether the Annapolis process will work. I tend to be rather cynical about it, but at least it's a subject for debate, or look at the economic perspective. But tonight we're going to look at it from the legal perspective. And I think it's very important to look at the conflict of Palestine from a legal perspective, from the perspective of international law. The dispute has always been characterized by legal disputation, starting with the 1947 resolution of the General Assembly recommending the partition of Palestine. Then there was the resolution 194 dealing with the right of returning refugees. In 1967, an important Security Council resolution on the non-admissibility of land acquired by forcible means following the 1967 war, and so on. But there's no doubt that today, if one thinks about international law in the context of the occupied Palestinian territory, one thinks of the 2004 advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice. What I'm going to suggest tonight is that Israel is guilty of serious violations of international law in general and human rights law in particular. And I'm going to suggest that this has serious implications for the rule of law in international affairs, for international human rights movement, and for the credibility of the United Nations. Why am I going to suggest this? The reason is that we have to be aware of the fact that the Security Council and General Assembly of the United Nations have repeatedly criticized Israel for violation of international law and human rights law. And in 2004, the International Court of Justice made a finding that the wall that Israel is presently constructing in the Palestinian territory is unlawful. But unfortunately, these resolutions of the
Security Council, the General Assembly, and now the impending International Court of Justice have to a large extent been ignored. Israel, the United States, and the European Union, in other words, by the so-called West. So today I'm going to speak very briefly about the opinion itself, criticism of the opinion, the authority of the opinion, and then the way in which the opinion has been treated by Israel and the international community. Briefly, for those of you who have not read the advisory opinion of 2004, the International Court, by 14 votes to 1, held that the wall Israel is constructing in Palestinian territory is illegal, that it should be dismantled, and that Israel should pay compensation for the construction of the wall. It also held that all states are obliged not to recognize the illegal situations resulting from the construction of the wall, and the United Nations was requested to consider what further action it might take to bring the illegal situation arising from the construction of the wall to an end. In making these findings, the International Court pronounced on a number of issues that have troubled the international community for many years, which have been at the center of the debate between Israel and particularly the developing world over features of Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territory. The court held that the Palestinians have a right to self-determination, held that the Fourth Geneva Convention dealing with the treatment of civilians in time of conflict, time of occupation, is binding on Israel in respect of the occupied Palestinian territory. It held, as the Security Council General Assembly has held for many years, that the construction, building of Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territory is unlawful. It held that the human rights covenants, civil and political rights, economic, social, and cultural rights, are binding upon Israel in the occupied Palestinian territory, and also found that Israel's annexation of East Jerusalem is illegal. In essence, the court found that the construction of the wall was illegal because it interfered with the right to self-determination of the Palestinian people, that it violated norms of international humanitarian law, particularly of the Fourth Geneva Convention, and that it violated the international human rights covenants. Now, I think one must acknowledge that the advisory opinion is not a model of perfection. I suspect that no judgment of any court is ever a model of perfection. I have my criticisms. I think that the court should simply have held that the wall was illegal because the purpose of the construction of the wall was to annex Palestinian territory in order to incorporate Israeli settlements into Israel itself. I wish the court had done this, and I think it would have been a much better judgment had it done so. But my criticism comes from one side, but obviously more criticisms from the other side. I'm not going to deal with all the criticisms levelled at the court, some of which are fair, some of which are grossly unfair. But I do want to deal with one criticism, and that is the argument that the court erred because it failed to make a factual investigation of the question whether Israel's argument that the wall had been built in Palestinian territory for security. Israel had argued that the purpose of the wall was to prevent suicide bombers from crossing from the West Bank into Israel, and that was the sole purpose for the construction of the wall. And the argument goes that the court failed to make a proper investigation into the correctness of Israel's position. Now, I'll give you three reasons why I think this criticism is invalid. First of all, the onus was on Israel to prove that this was the purpose of the construction. But Israel chose not to appear before the International Court and to make submissions on the reasons for the construction of the wall. In this case, Israel failed to behave as South Africa did in 1971 when the court gave an advisory opinion on Namibia. South Africa appeared before the court and presented legal arguments, which were not accepted, but at least South Africa did the decent thing and appeared before the court. But Israel simply refused to appear before the court. That's a good legal entitled to do so, but it's very difficult for Israel to come along or later and say, well, you didn't consider our arguments, but Israel never raised these arguments before the court. Secondly, I think it's very difficult to argue that one may construct a wall in foreign territory for the purposes of security. Imagine if Canada decided that it wished to build a security wall to protect it against the United States. And instead of building it along the Canadian border, it built it within the territory of the United States. It's very difficult to justify the construction of the wall within Palestinian territory as a security measure. But the main reason why I say that the Israeli argument is invalid is that at the time the case was argued, it was shown that the purpose of the wall was to incorporate Israeli settlements into Israeli settlements in the West Bank, that is, into Israeli territory. It was pointed out that the wall was constructed in such a way that it enclosed 83% of Israel's settlers in the West Bank, some 69 settlements. So, on the face of it, it seemed that the purpose of the wall was not to provide security to Israel, but rather to seize land for Israel by incorporating settlements into Israel. In 2004, Israel denied this vehemently, and Israel kept up this pretense for several years. But in more recent times, Israeli politicians have been much more honest about it, and they said quite openly that the purpose of the war is largely political. It's not built in Palestinian territory for security reasons, but to enclose or to incorporate Israeli settlements into Israel's territory. So today, that argument that was raised against the court has simply disappeared, because it is acknowledged by Israel itself that the purpose of the war is both to provide security, and you can acknowledge that that could have been done by building it along the green line, the boundary between Israel and Palestine. So the main purpose seems was largely to seize land for Israel by transferring the settlements into Israeli territory. Well, so much for the opinion. What about the authority of the opinion? As I said, it was adopted by 14 to 1. The sole dissenter was the American judge, Bergenthal. But I think it's important to stress that Judge Bergenthal agreed with many of the findings of the majority. He agreed that Palestinians have a right to self-determination. He agreed that the human rights covenants are binding on Israel in the chair. We agreed that the Fourth Geneva Convention is binding upon Israel. We agreed that settlements are unlawful. So one can really say that 14 and a half of the judges of the International Court agreed with the finding of the court. Of course, it is an advisory opinion, and as the word suggests, it's not binding upon member states as such. As the opinion declares, the law, Israel is obliged to comply with the law, is obliged to acknowledge that the human rights covenants are binding upon it, and the Fourth Geneva Convention is binding. But as an advisory opinion, it's not binding upon Israel, is not binding upon the United States. But it is binding upon the United Nations, because it is the law of the United Nations. It's the law as declared by the judicial arm of the United Nations, and so it is the law of the United Nations, which means that the United Nations, and particularly the Secretary General, is obliged to comply with it. Now, what has happened to this advisory opinion? How has it been treated? Well, first of all, it's been completely ignored by Israel. Israel has proceeded with the construction of the wall. Some 200 kilometers have been added to the wall since 2004. Settlements have increased, checkpoints, roadblocks, another issue that troubled the court, have also increased. We now have over 600 roadblocks, checkpoints, which obstruct Palestinian freedom of movement. Quite clear that Palestinian self-determination has suffered, not only as a result of the construction of the wall, but also as a result of the separation of Gaza and the West Bank. And of course the humanitarian crisis has also worsened in the West Bank and in Gaza. So it's, I think, very fair to say that Israel has not only ignored the opinion, but that the situation has deteriorated substantially since 2004. Has the international community done anything about it? Well, in 2004, the General Assembly did approve the adoption, or adopted a resolution approving the advisory opinion. That resolution was adopted by 150 votes to 6. That 150 included all members of the European Union and the Russian Federation. The 6 included Israel, the United States, Australia — that wouldn't happen today, I think — and of course the 3 major powers in the South Pacific: Micronesia, Marshall Islands, and But what about the Security Council, the most important organ of the United Nations? It has done nothing. It has not adopted any resolution giving any acknowledgement, let alone approval, to the advisory committee. That's because of the US veto. Then we have the strange body called the Quartet, comprising the United Nations, the Russian Federation, the United States, and the European Union, which is supposed to be responsible for furthering the peace process in the region. This body meets every 3 months and adopts high-sounding statements and does little else. But the interesting thing is that these statements never even mention the advisory opinion, despite the fact that it is, after all, the law of the United Nations. And I think that what is very unacceptable is that the Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Ban Ki-moon, never even mentions the advisory opinion himself. He's made many statements on the subject. He always refers to this so-called roadmap. He studiously avoids any mention of the advisory opinion. Now, I think in order to understand the position of Ban Ki-moon, one should compare him with the President of the United States at the time of Brown versus the Board of Education. You will recall that President Eisenhower was then President of the United States. He didn't like the opinion, the judgment of the court. He didn't like the Chief Justice, who he had appointed by mistake, he said. But President Eisenhower did accept the judgment of the Supreme Court in Brown versus the Board of Education. He said that it was his responsibility and duty as president to observe and to implement the judgment of the court. You will recall that he even was supposed to send federal troops to schools and universities in the South. Now, surely that's the way that the Secretary General of the United Nations ought to be held. And I think that the Secretary General of the United Nations is guilty of serious misconduct in his failure to even attempt to implement the advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice. Let me end by saying that I think this has serious implications for the rule of law in international affairs. We have a situation in which the United Nations, the Security Council in particular, the Secretary General, refuse to even acknowledge, let alone implement, the opinion of the International Court of Justice dealing with human rights issues and international humanitarian law. So I think it's a very serious threat to the rule of law in international affairs. It's also something that seriously affects the credibility of the United Nations, particularly the Security Council and the Secretary General. I have seen the consequences of this in the Human Rights Council. The Human Rights Council is accused of bias in the sense that it spends an inordinate amount of time dealing with Israel and it fails to deal with more important human rights issues, perhaps such as Zimbabwe, Burma, Myanmar, Sudan. But I think in order to understand this, one must see it from the perspective of the developing world. What the developing world is in effect saying is if the West is prepared to apply a double standard in respect of Israel and to condone Israel's violations of human rights, don't expect us, the developing world, to take action against our members in the developing world who are violating human rights. We are going to apply a double standard as well. So I believe that the human rights movement, which has been one of the most important developments in international law since the Second World War, is now seriously threatened by the divisions between the West and the developing world over the compliance with international law by Israel. And I'd like to leave you with that thought this evening. Thank you.
Possibly a show of hands. How many of you read the International Court of Justice ruling? Yeah. We definitely have a minority here at Berkeley. So your assignment, your homework, is to actually go in and see it, read it for yourself. Right? That's what a university is all about. For us to go, read the material, understand what it's saying, and then if you feel that there's something that you could act upon, then we could pass it and actually convey it to the others. Because in the U.S., many people are not attuned to the need for bringing about change in U.S. policy relative to Palestine and relative to the Israel-Palestine conflict. Until we take ourselves seriously, take the materials, act upon it, and convey it to the others, then we actually are not using what's available there for us to be advocates on behalf of human rights and International Court of Justice opinion. So my recommendation to you, as we heard Professor John Legard speaking about this important issue, for us to do it, and we have no excuse. You can Google it right here while you're sitting, right? Because I know many of you will sit in that class and you Google in the back of that class. So you can go and Google an important part and don't engage in Googling something that is not useful. Our next, also another piece, both will be speaking tomorrow at Santa Clara University. Right? I'm also a very big supporter of technology where it's useful. So if you have a Facebook or if you have an account that you could direct your friends in the South Bay to attend the lecture tomorrow at Santa Clara University, please do so.
Meyer Theatre.
What is it?
Meyer Theatre.
Meyer Theatre at Santa Clara University. That's how we can tell our people that we are affiliated with. I know many of you have Facebook and I know you text message all the time. Right? So here, use the technology to bring about social change and use the technology to bring about change in the Palestinians when funded by making sure that the event tomorrow at Santa Clara University is well attended. Our second speaker for the evening is Professor Norman Finkelstein. He received his doctorate in 1988 from the Department of Politics at Princeton University. That, I don't know how they gave you the PhD at the time, but it's something that we could discuss. For many years, he taught political theory and the Israel-Palestine conflict. He is currently an independent scholar, and as an independent scholar who speaks truth to power, because if you speak truth to power, you most often will end up being an independent scholar. And that is a celebrated scholar. Being an independent scholar is a celebrated title because you have the ability to give judgment on the issues that you see in the world today. Because often in the current period, and I think we could see the university being transformed on the one hand as a corporate entity, we're selling departments by the million. If you have a few million, I'll sell your department. Right? While on the other hand, the wedding of the university into the military-industrial complex. That's why if you want to make money at the university, just be sure to study science and hook up yourself with a big lab that produces the weapons of mass destruction. And I always say Berkeley is number one. We're the number one university in the world in the research, production, manufacturing, and promotion of weapons of mass destruction. Right? If you think about it, chemical and biological weapons, we are the best at it. We have developed the best nuclear weapons in the world here in Berkeley. We're number one, not in the football game, but in the production of weapons of mass destruction. Professor Finkelstein had many books. His most recent book, which will be published in 2009, and I'll bet you he will be attacked for it, Farewell to Israel, The Coming Breakup of American Zionism. So basically prepare yourself for the attack that will be coming to our independent scholar, Professor Norman Finkelstein.
Can you hear me okay? People in the back, can you hear me? Oh, good. So we'll just use
so much.
Well, thank you for having me, and I'm genuinely pleased to be able to share the panel with Professor Dugard. I'm not generous usually with my compliments, but he genuinely deserves it. Anyone who read his reports from 2001 through this past year will know that they were models of meticulousness, seriousness, and I have to say I respect they were also models of caution. And I also had a chance for some things I was writing to read through his scholarly publications, and although they were probably a little bit too specialized for me, the parts that I understood were very impressive, and I'll be quoting from some of it this evening. I'm going to be speaking on the broader issues that the International Court of Justice raised in its advisory opinion maybe before it was able to reach the opinion that the wall was illegal, the International Court had to lay out some fundamental principles of international law on the basis of which they reached their opinion. And I'll be speaking of those fundamental principles. I want to begin with a quote I came across while reading somebody somewhat far afield, namely Gandhi. I was reading through his collected works, which are quite substantial, about 90 hefty volumes, 500 pages each. And I was reading through them, and I came across this remark of his. He said, "All compromise is based on give and take, but there can be no give and take on fundamentals. Any compromise on fundamentals is a surrender, for it is all give and no take. The time for compromise can only come when both sides are of one mind on fundamentals." Well, the obvious question that I call begs is, what are these fundamentals on which there can be no compromise? And my own opinion, for what it's worth, is that in the current world, the only standard available is the standard of international law. Those are the fundamentals on which, to quote Gandhi, there can be no compromise. You might say 20 years ago, when I was still a student, or even 30 years ago, you could say there was a competing set of fundamental principles. At that time it was called some version of Marxism, sometimes Marxism-Leninism. But you could say, I think fairly, that that, as it were, subversive version of fundamental principles has now, for better or for worse, has been effaced, and what we're left with, again for better or for worse, is international law. That's the only available standard to judge the fundamental principles on which there can be no compromise. And I will argue in the time that's allotted me that there's a remarkable consensus on the fundamentals for resolving the Israel-Palestine conflict, and that Israel is the main obstacle to a resolution of the conflict on the basis of these fundamentals. Let me begin with a remark by Jimmy Carter in his last book, or penultimate book, I think he's written another since. In Palestine, Peace on Apartheid, he said, "Israel's continued control and colonization of Palestinian land has been the primary obstacle to a comprehensive peace agreement. Peace will come to Israel and the Middle East only when the Israeli government is willing to comply with international law by accepting its legal borders." That was considered something of a controversial opinion when Mr. Carter articulated his book. In fact, it's not so controversial as it may seem for those who are familiar with the scholarly literature in the Israel-Palestine conflict. There was a very noted leading scholar in international law, a fellow by the name of Quincy Wright, who I checked with Professor Dugard, and he knew him. And already in 1970, so we're talking about some 40 years ago, already in 1970, Quincy Wright wrote, "In view of the acceptance in principle of the resolution 242 by the adjacent Arab states except Syria, the major obstacle to progress seems to be the refusal of Israel to do so and to agree to withdraw from occupied territories." Well, it sounds very much like Carter, but as I said, it was 40 years ago. Well, a reasonable question which many of you may think, not necessarily having studied the law, would be, why should Israel have to withdraw? Other countries acquired territory by war. Why shouldn't Israel be allowed to? Or the other version of that argument, in 1967, Israel fought a war of self-defense, and shouldn't, or armed countries, allowed to acquire territory in the course of a war of self-defense. Those arguments are fairly well known, and then the only thing that we can do is look at the historical record, what happened in 1967, and then look at the legal record on this principle of acquiring territory by war. The historical record on what happened in June 1967 is still somewhat murky, but certain points are pretty clear, or I would say at this point, they're entirely clear. Neither Israeli nor U.S. officials believe that Israel faced an imminent threat to its existence when it launched its first strike in June 5th, 1967. In my opinion, and I'll be happy to go through the documentary record, that's a clear and unequivocal point. We know it for very good reasons. At the end of May 1967, when the war seemed imminent, or a clash seemed imminent between Israel and the neighboring Arab states, in particular Egypt and Syria, but also Jordan, U.S. Intelligence agencies went back over and over again, checking two questions. Would Egypt attack? And if it attacked, what would happen to Israel? And over again, our intelligence agencies, about six different intelligence agencies, checked. And over again, they reached the same conclusions. Number one, Egypt wouldn't attack. And number two, if they did attack, to quote the then President Lyndon Johnson, if they did get attacked, you're going to whip the hell out of them. Well, that's the American opinion. What was the Israeli opinion? Well, we know for sure what the Israeli opinion was, because on June 1st, the head of Israeli internal security, the head of the Mossad, Major General Meir Amit, was in Washington. And when he was asked, what's the opinion of the Israelis on what's going to happen, he replied, now I'm quoting him exactly, "There were no differences between the U.S. and the Israelis on the military intelligence picture or its interpretation." There were no differences. What was the U.S. opinion? There was going to be no attack, and if it did happen, Israel would whip the hell out of them. And complete agreement between the Israelis and the Americans. So there's no argument whatsoever, exactly zero, you could say. There's no argument whatsoever that Israel fought a war of self-defense in June 1967. It was a first strike. It was not a preemptive attack. If you turn immediately after the June 67 war, the fifth emergency session of the UN General Assembly met in order to discuss the outcome of the war. The member states of the General Assembly were divided between those holding Israel responsible for the war, those holding both sides responsible for the war, those saying it's impossible to tell who is responsible, and then there were those countries which just didn't comment. The only country in the world, literally, the only country in the world that maintained Israel had acted in self-defense against Egyptian aggression was Israel. That was not the opinion expressed by the United States. The American opinion, as expressed by Arthur Goldberg, who was the UN representative at the time, was that both sides bore responsibility for the outbreak of hostilities. Well, some of you may not agree with my reading of the record, fine. Let's, for the sake of argument, say Israel did engage in a war of self-defense. If it did engage in this war of self-defense, does that then give it the right to keep the territory it acquired? And here we have a fairly lengthy record of legal opinion on the topic, or at least leading authorities speaking on it. Among the leading authorities, for those of you who follow the field, would surely have been, back then, Brownlee, Jennings, and Bowers. All three of them agreed, there was a consensus, that even in a war of self-defense, a country is not entitled to acquire territory. I'll just quote Jennings, who wrote one of the main studies at the time, in 1963. He said it would be a curious law of self-defense that permitted the defender in the course of his defense to seize and keep the resources and territory of the attacker. The recent scholarly opinion concurs, even if it is a war of self-defense, it's inadmissible to acquire territory. The main scholarly studies by this woman, Corman, but here I'll quote the other person on the panel this evening, namely Professor Dugard. I guess it was his Cambridge lectures, and in the course of them he addresses this particular issue, and he says as follows: the United Nations expressly refuses to accept the argument that territory may be permanently acquired as a result of action taken in lawful self-defense. Large majorities in the General Assembly in support of this principle, namely you can't acquire territory by war, even if it's self-defense, and the failure of any major power to veto it in the Security Council, must surely provide evidence that this principle is part of the international public order and by implication a peremptory norm.
From the river to the sea, Israel will be free. From the river, hey, let's go!
Israel. If you go back and look at the record, Arthur Goldberg, speaking to the General Assembly, was very clear. One component of the settlement had to be a full Israeli withdrawal to the June 4, 1967 border. As most of you know, again, the issue came up in the Security Council in November 1967. When the UN General Security Council Resolution 242 was passed, with the famous preambular paragraph stating that it's inadmissible to acquire territory by war. There are 15 members of the Security Council. 14 of the 15 members of the Security Council either during the Security Council deliberations or during the General Assembly deliberations, 14 of the 15 explicitly endorsed the principle of full withdrawal. The only exception was Nationalist China, which at the time was having its credentials challenged and didn't participate in debate. The US, again, it officially adhered to the principle of the inadmissibility of the acquiring of territory by war, allowing for the exception of minor and mutual land swaps, to which I'll return later. In 1970, the United Nations General Assembly, by acclamation, passed the Declaration of Principles of International Law, in which it stated, and I'm quoting, "The territory of a state shall not be the object of acquisition by another state resulting from the threat or use of force." Notice it doesn't specify aggressive self-defense. You cannot acquire territory by force under international law. Well, what does the recent record look like? The recent record actually is remarkably unambiguous. Everybody in this room who Googles the back of the room, although I doubt they're Googling ICJ opinions or UN General Assembly resolutions, all you have to do is Google the words peaceful settlement of the question of Palestine. Peaceful settlement of the question of Palestine. Every year, that resolution comes up before the United Nations General Assembly. And that resolution, among the tenets for achieving a peaceful settlement of the question of Palestine, it includes these: affirming the principle of the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war, affirming the illegality of the Israeli settlements, stressing the withdrawal of Israel from the Palestinian territory occupied since 1967, and stressing the UN Resolution 194 for resolving the refugee question. Those are the tenets. What is the vote? You can check for yourself, it's quite illuminating. I'll go through quickly the last 10 years. 1997, 155-2. 1998, 154-2. 1999, 149-2. Skipping a little, 2002, 160-4. 2005, 156-6. 2007, 161-7. The votes are always the same, and the dissents are always the same. The whole world on one side, and the other side, the United States, Israel, Nauru, N-A-U-R-U, Tuvalu, T-U-V-A-L-U, Palau, P-A-L-A-U, Micronesia, and the Marshall Islands. That's it. The whole world on one side, those major powers in the Pacific on the other. And that now brings us to the current state, namely the most recent addition to the record, namely the ICJ opinion in 2004. In the opinion, it begins by laying out what it calls the rules and principles of international law which are relevant in assessing the legality of the measures taken by Israel. And it lists these rules and principles. One, no territorial acquisition resulting from the threat or use of force shall be recognized as legal. Two, the policy and practices of Israel in establishing the settlements in the Palestinian and other Arab territories acquired since 1967 has no legal validity. And then at the end of the opinion, it ran through the its findings. I won't detain you with them now, except to point out it reiterated these principles in the context of the Israel-Palestine conflict, and notably also stated, as does throughout the opinion, the court concludes that the Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territory Haran, including East Jerusalem, have been established in breach of international law. Now, regarding these basic principles and tenets, not one of the 15 judges sitting in the ICJ registered dissent from these basic principles and findings. It can scarcely be said that they evinced prejudice against Israel, or that it was, in the words of Harvard Professor Alan Dershowitz, a kangaroo court. Because if you read the opinion, and there were many separate opinions apart from the majority opinion, the separate opinions expressed profound, and in my opinion at any rate, undue sympathy for Israel in the course of their opinions. For example, the opinion of Judge Ruth Higgins, judge from the United Kingdom. If the judges were nearly of one mind in their final determination, the consensus came not from collective prejudice, but from the factual situation. That is, the uncontroversial nature of the legal principles at stake, and Israel's uncontroversial breach of them. As Professor Dugard has already mentioned, on the fundamental issue, namely the issue of the settlements, it was a unanimous opinion. It wasn't 14 out of 15, it was 15 out of 15. Judge Bergenthal was careful not to call his separate opinion a dissent. He used a more subdued language, he called it a declaration. And as Professor Dugard said, he begins by saying there's much in the majority opinion I agree with. But then crucially, in the question of the settlements, he says, paragraph 6 of Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention does not admit for exception on grounds of military or security exigencies. It provides that the occupying power shall not deport or transfer parts of its own civilian population to the territory it occupies. And then Mr. Bergenthal goes on to say, I agree that this provision applies to the Israeli settlements in the West Bank, and that their existence violates Article 49, paragraph 6. Well, that means, of all what are called the final status questions in Israel-Palestine, that and under international law resolves all of them except the one of the refugees, which obviously the court didn't address because it was addressing the legality of the war. But there's also no dispute whatsoever on international law on the status of the right of return to the Palestinian refugees. As I already mentioned, that's one of the tenets of that UN resolution on the peaceful settlement of the Palestine question, which gains near unanimous support in the international community. What's even more illuminating is all the major human rights organizations have issued statements clearly supporting the right of return. These are not radical organizations, these are not Marxist subversive organizations. We're talking about Human Rights Watch, which, quote, urges Israel to recognize the right to return for those Palestinians and their descendants who fled from territory that is now within the state of Israel. Or Amnesty International, which, quote, calls for Palestinians who fled or expelled from Israel, the West Bank, or Gaza Strip, along with those of their descendants who maintain general links, to be able to exercise their right of return. No debate on these issues. There's exactly zero controversy. Exactly zero controversy on, to use Gandhi's words, the fundamentals of international law as they pertain to the Israel-Palestine conflict. Fundamentals on which there can be no compromise. It's interesting, and I'll leave it at that, to compare what the actual record shows with how it's distilled in the American public, or for the American public. So let's take the case of the famous Camp David summit of 2000. And we all know the famous story about Prime Minister Barak's generous offer, which the Palestinians and all their fanaticism and blindness turned down. So what did the generous offer look like? under international law, Israel has zero title to any of the West Bank, any of Gaza, and any of East Jerusalem. They are, to quote the International Court of Justice, occupied Palestinian territories. Gandhi says there can be no compromise on fundamentals. But Israel's offer was it would return 77% of the occupied territories immediately, and another 10% the Jordan Valley between 6 and 20 years. The question of settlements, everybody agrees, no dispute, no debate, illegal under Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. Gandhi says there can be no compromise on fundamentals. Israel's offer, it wants to keep 60% of the settlements and 80% of the settlers within its own territory. Jerusalem, under international law, East Jerusalem was acquired by war in June 1967. It's inadmissible to acquire territory by war. The ICJ says it's occupied Palestinian territory. Gandhi says the fundamental can't compromise on principles. What does Israel offer? It offers the Palestinians sovereignty over a few outlying villages of East Jerusalem, the rest be maintained under Israeli sovereignty. Refugees. 194, the right of return and compensation. UN General Assembly every year votes in support of that provision. 194 votes 161-7 this past year, fairly typically. Unambiguous principle of international law, embraced by Human Rights Watch, embraced by the Amnesty International. What does Israel offer? On the question of refugees, it offers a token return of some of the refugees. And Mr. Barak afterwards says, to quote him, Israel accepts no legal, moral, or historical responsibility for what happened to the Palestinian refugees in 1948. That's the record. And I think that it's useful to both contemplate Gandhi's position, since he's supposedly a very reasonable person, look at the historical record, look at what Israel's offering, and decide for yourself who's being unreasonable and incompetent. Thank you.
I'll give each speaker a minute and a half for their questions.